Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, January 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the partial U.S. government shutdown continues into its 33rd day as federal workers worry how they'll feed themselves.
How long are they going to continue to do nothing to actually fix the problem?
A setback for transgender Americans serving in the U.S. military. North Korea reported to be continuing to have secret missile sites. And coming up, the Oscar nominees have been announced. We will have details. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the White House is moving ahead with plans for President Trump to deliver a televised State of the Union address to both chambers of Congress on the evening of January 29th, despite calls from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to delay the speech until a partial government shutdown ends. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders spoke to reporters outside of the West Wing a few hours ago. She argued that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi invited the president to give a State of the Union and didn't mention that as the she didn't mention that after the shutdown dragged on, Pelosi followed up by asking the president to postpone it or send in writing.
He accepted. She cited security concerns as a potential reason to delay it. Those concerns were addressed by the Department of Homeland Security and the United States Secret Service. At this point, we're moving forward.
VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman was there at the White House when Sanders spoke to reporters Tuesday, and I spoke to him earlier about it. Steve, what did she have to say?
Sarah Sanders spoke to a group of reporters outside the West Wing on the North Lawn driveway and said that they are moving ahead with the president delivering a State of the Union next Tuesday evening on Capitol Hill. Now, she did not specifically say it would be to both chambers of Congress, but they did send an email on Sunday to the Sergeant-at-Arms of the House asking for a walkthrough planning session so that everything would be in order. But we do know also that there are alternative plans for the address to possibly be made in a different location, depending on whether the government shutdown is still going on. And there are even some officials saying that this could be done at a political rally. But it does appear that the preference is to have a traditional State of the Union address to both chambers of the House, have it nationally televised, and the pomp and circumstance that goes with that type of speech.
Now, could the president follow through on that at the Capitol, even if Nancy Pelosi does not give her blessing for this?
Well, that is a question, because the protocol would be for there to be this formal invitation. So we expect that there may be some behind-the-scenes maneuvering going on. And a lot of this may depend, Lori, on what happens on Thursday in the Senate with the rival bills that Republicans and Democrats have put forward to end the government shutdown and provide some funds for the government. The big difference, of course, between the two bills is the Republican bill has that $5.7 billion that President Trump wants for the wall on the border with Mexico, while the Democratic Party proposal has $0 for a border wall funding.
How is that moving anything forward, and how is that a compromise plan when they're both basically digging their heels in for what they want and neither side is willing to give in to the other?
Well, I guess you could be either a little bit optimistic or a little bit cynical and say, oh, at least they're going to have a vote, that something has been put forward, but there do not appear to be the votes there to pass either of the bills. So the finger-pointing continues, with both the Republicans and Democrats pointing at each other and accusing the others of holding these 800,000 federal workers hostage.
So no real end in sight at this point?
Besides the fact that there is going to be a vote on Thursday, there's nothing that the reporters here at the White House or up on the Hill are aware of, any sort of behind-the-scenes negotiations that could lead to a breakthrough. But who knows? It is a big black hole and a mystery, and there's a lot of reasons to be pessimistic about this going on for a while and very little to be optimistic as we speak.
The president said that he's pretty much given Sarah Huckabee Sanders permission to not go to the podium or to do these White House press briefings anymore because because she's been treated very unfairly. What are you hearing about that?
Well, the president was tweeting about this because a deputy press secretary, Hogan Gidley, earlier in the day on a friendly forum for the White House, the Fox News channel, was asked about it. And what the president tweeted after all of this was that the reason the press secretary doesn't go to the podium much anymore is because the media is covering her rudely and inaccurately. And he told her not to bother, that the word will get out anyway. And he claims that most of the media does not cover his administration fairly. Well, shortly after that, one of the White House officials, Larry Kudlow, was in the press briefing room doing an interview with the CNBC cable network because it was so darn cold outside, 0 degrees Celsius at that point. And he was descended on by a bunch of people and convinced to get up on the podium and have an impromptu briefing. That lasted for a few minutes until an aide came up and whispered in his ear, and then he quickly made an exit. And then we had on Tuesday evening Sarah Sanders, again in sub-freezing temperatures, speaking outside to a group of reporters when it could have been done inside in the warmth of the press briefing room.
I guess there's just really no precedence for this.
Obviously, the president has felt that there is little value in doing what has been a tradition for many administrations of having what were once daily briefings. Then they sort of went to weekly or a couple times a month, and recently we've been down to about one a month or so. And based on what the president has now tweeted, they're going to continue to be rare. And you can talk to anybody inside this administration, and they will tell you that the president believes he is his own best spokesman, and by doing the friendly interviews that he does with Fox News and a few others, or just getting out the word on Twitter, that is the best way to communicate to the media and the public.
All right, that is White House correspondent Steve Herman. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Amid Brexit woes and EU squabbles, France's Emmanuel Macron and Germany's Angela Merkel meet. Indonesian campus rape victims seek justice but fears criminalization. A Russian court denies bail to a former U.S. Marine accused of spying. And an ex-Canadian diplomat businessman has been arrested in an apparent retaliation of Canada's arrest of a Chinese telecom executive. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. One of some 20 undeclared ballistic missile operating bases in North Korea serves as a missile headquarters. It's part of the findings of a new report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The report says the Sino-Ri missile operating base and the Nodong missiles deployed at this location fit into North Korea's presumed nuclear military strategy by providing an operational level nuclear or conventional first strike capability. The discovery of an undeclared missile headquarters comes 3 days after President Donald Trump announced Friday that he looks forward to another summit to discuss denuclearization with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late February. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Paul Evans, professor in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
Well, I don't think that the discovery of the missile base, while it's new news, it's an old story. There's been no effort by the North Koreans to disclose or identify where their nuclear and their missile capabilities lie. So this is not a I don't think it's a new piece of information that suddenly clouds the meeting. This is the reality of the situation. The U.S. North Korea discussion at the head of government level is very preliminary. It has not even got to the basics yet of exactly what can be revealed, what can't be revealed, much less than how things are going to start being removed.
What kind of effect might that have on the next summit meeting if it is to take place?
It would be difficult to imagine this stopping the meeting because both sides have known that this has not yet been part of even an agreement on the declaration of facilities. It underlines how difficult this next summit meeting is going to be, on the basis of there having been very little progress on any of the inferred actions by North Korea, and the United States still not winding down the sanctions. So it's almost as if we're in a time warp where we're going back as if it's a first meeting that didn't cover some ground. Whether it can or not, the odds are not very high that something breakthrough is going to come here, but hope springs eternal.
Given that, what does either side, or both sides for that matter, want to get out of this meeting?
Well, I think that the politics for both sides are important. Mr. Trump is trying to move ahead with a special initiative in his own special way that he hopes will produce some kind of result. I think the more interesting logic is right now on the North Korean side. And as before earlier meetings, this is being accompanied by a series of interactions with South Korea, but particularly with China. So whether under those circumstances, President Kim is going to come with any new kinds of proposals is in question. I think, you know, we can't distance this from the U.S.-China economic negotiations. I mean, Xi Jinping is in many ways in the middle of both a difficult negotiation with the United States on trade, but he is also the broker. He's the person who can have at least some influence on what Kim is willing to put on that table. And so this could be a desire to stall for time, to let this thing run later, to see where the U.S.-China negotiations go. Or he may see some help Kim take some steps towards keeping the process in play with the U.S.
How much input do you think Xi Jinping has had already, given the last meeting between he and Kim just a week or two ago?
Well, it's correct that the North Koreans are not moving very far without consultations, obviously, with Xi. And whether that is going to produce leverage to move forward, or whether it's going to be a delay and keep the status quo, the murky status quo, indefinitely. I think, you know, the other factor that has come into play in this is that if we imagine four musicians trying to play a quartet, we have essentially North Korea, China, and increasingly South Korea playing to one kind of melody, whereas the United States is something on the outside. It has the biggest instrument, but it is listening, and it is not in it. It's not the lead instrument in this quartet going forward. And that's what makes all of this so peculiar, is that you have three countries going in one kind of direction on this, and the U.S. Both divided and not moving forward in its ambitions.
That's Paul Evans, professor in the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled Tuesday that the Trump administration can enforce its restrictions on transgender people in the military, while lower court cases contest their exclusion. The High Court overturned lower court rulings that had blocked the Defense Department from implementing the restrictions, but for now also declined to consider the legality of keeping transgender people out of the U.S. Armed Forces. The Pentagon in years past had banned transgender people from serving in the military, but former President Barack Obama's administration reversed that. The Trump administration reviewed the policy and sought to limit the service of transgender people to only those who are not seeking to undergo gender transitions. Joining us now to discuss, Los Angeles-based attorney Angela Reddick Wright with the Reddick Law Office. Was this unusual for the Supreme Court to do, given that the issue is still being argued in the lower courts?
I would venture to guess that it's more politically motivated than out of a necessity to make a decision at this time. Justice Roberts would disagree with that and would argue that his court is not politically influenced.
What does this mean for transgender people already in the military who are serving at this point?
So what the ban means if you're currently serving in the military is you can continue to serve as long as you are willing to serve while openly and willingly revealing your biological sex, in essence, by serving in the gender that you were born with. If you're not, then there's a possibility that you would be discharged. And of course, if you are transgender and you're interested in joining the military, there's a ban on your joining until the final decision is made by the Supreme Court.
I would imagine that would be a difficult decision for transgender military people that are already serving, given that that's whatever sex they've decided to be, that that's what they identify with. So they would have to sort of transform themselves back to something they don't feel that they are?
Right. They have to make a decision that goes against the choice they've made in terms of their gender, and most likely would have to make sure that they dress and associate and do everything associated with their biological sex or gender. So that would be a difficult decision. And for those that also, take it on as a position of advocacy, they also would have to compromise what they've advocated for in terms of transgender rights. So it definitely puts those of a transgender background and that make the choice to be transgender, that are transgender, in a difficult position.
What are the civil rights implications of the ban? Is there any precedence for it? Is there any constitutional basis one way or the other, as far as you can tell?
So I'm not aware of any precedent for the Supreme Court taking action before a matter is heard before the lower court. That's how our system works. It goes through the lower court system, and eventually, should the Supreme Court decide to take up an issue, they take up the issue. But for the Supreme Court to take a position now signals how they may look at this issue once it actually, comes to them after being in the lower courts. So there's no precedence for that I'm aware of. And when you ask the question of whether the ban itself is constitutional, what that ultimately will turn on, the civil rights laws in the U.S., Title VII, say you cannot discriminate against individuals based on their race, gender, sex, etc. So the big question will be, is this a form of discrimination against individuals based on their gender and their sex? The counter argument will come from the president and the military, which says, for whatever reasons, that individuals serving outside of their biological gender or sex somehow presents a harm to the military and to the individuals that they're serving with, and presents a harm to protecting the interests of the United States. Whether that argument will succeed, ultimately I think it depends on the views of the justice system. Right now we obviously have a conservative majority, so it's most likely that the conservative majority will buy into the argument that's being presented by the president and the military. However, I think if when you look at the arguments of advocates on the other side, they will argue vehemently that this is a clear form of discrimination against a body of individuals, a sect of individuals based on their gender and based on their sex. But ultimately, the question will boil down to that.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. That's Angela Reddick Wright, attorney based in Los Angeles. Well, Kenyan authorities have reopened the Dusit D2 hotel and office complex to the people who were working there when it came under attack last week, Mohammed Youssef reports.
It is the first time civilians have been allowed to access the area since the attack, which claimed the lives of 21 people. Kenyan security agencies continue to investigate how the incident was planned and those who may have helped the five assailants in the terror operation. Investigators widened their search to the eastern town of Isiolo, where arrests were made. So far, authorities have taken at least 11 people into custody and interrogated dozens of others. Government spokesman Eric Raide says authorities will get to the bottom of the attack.
Well, the security situation is calm and all the security services are alert. Investigations involving Dusit 2 are going on. We have made a number of arrests so far, about 8. All these are persons of interest, and we are satisfied that the investigations are going on well, and those who are involved in this will justice will be done.
Authorities have brought before the court 6 suspects whom they believe to be behind the attack. Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. Al-Shabaab has vowed to fight Kenya so long as its troops are stationed in Somalia to support that country's government in establishing peace and stability. Some experts say the group will continue with its threats and attacks, even if Kenya withdraws its troops from Somalia. Kenyan security agencies have been praised for how they handled the latest terror attack by quickly evacuating people and ending the siege in under 20 hours. But analysts believe the country needs to rethink its strategies to stop Al-Shabaab from recruiting among Kenyan youth. Anela Botha is a terrorism researcher.
Al-Shabaab has been successful, especially in areas where you have vulnerable communities, people feeling marginalized due to a number of reasons. It can be religious, it can be ethnic, as some of the areas that I think that they abused before. But also frustration towards the Kenyan government has also been proving quite successful in the hands of Al-Shabaab.
Mustafa Ali is Horn of Africa security expert based in Nairobi.
I think what Kenya needs to do is to relook at its ideological pushback countering violent extremism strategies. While the security agencies have done very well to address violent extremism and terrorism, the areas community mobilization awareness is something that has lagged behind. And that's something that the country needs to look at more carefully.
Kenyan media report one of the assailants slipped through the border to carry out an attack. Some security officers have been accused of corruption, with authorities saying this has led to the smuggling of firearms and Al-Shabaab fighters. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. For over 50 years, Oscar-winning filmmaker and actor Clint Eastwood has portrayed tough characters, bounty hunters, police detectives, and macho heartthrobs. In his latest movie, The Mule, the octogenarian now softens his masculine persona to interpret a frail old man whose financial hardship forces him to take up a job as a drug courier or a mule for a Mexican drug cartel. VOA's Penelope Pulu has details.
Oh. Need help, sir?
Oh, officer, hi.
You need help?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
What do you got there?
Pecans. I'm delivering pecans to my niece.
And pecans? Syrup.
Yeah, pecans. She makes the worst pecan pie you've ever tasted.
No cop would suspect that Earl Stone is trafficking drugs. An old, upright white man, Stone is above suspicion. But despite his quiet demeanor, Stone is resilient and the cartel's top mule, transporting millions of dollars worth of cocaine. A seasoned traveler who spent his career driving around the country as a horticulturalist, he knows how to navigate the American road system. He is never stopped for traffic violations and operates under the DEA agents' noses, even when he crosses paths with top agent Colin Bates, bent on capturing the elusive mule no one has ever seen, but everyone is talking about.
You gotta think about family.
Yeah.
Anniversary is important. But you know, I'm the king of missing anniversaries. That's the problem, yes.
That's the first one I've missed. So.
Good luck. Don't follow my footsteps and do what I did. I put work in front of family. And this is the most important thing.
Bradley Cooper plays Officer Bates. He describes Eastwood's character.
It's a man on a path, reckoning his past, reckoning for his making up for mistakes, making peace with himself. But it's a reckoning for how he's lived his life.
Stone's financial troubles and his desire to make up for past mistakes and lost chances with his estranged wife and daughter lies at the heart of the story. Broke and rejected by his family, he takes the job as a drug mule, not out of greed, at least in the beginning, but out of despair to make things right. And though that is part of the film narrative, in some way, it reflects Eastwood's real life. Iris, his estranged on-screen daughter, is played by his real daughter, Allison Eastwood, who says she did not always have the best relationship with her dad.
It's been challenging because I do have such a great relationship with my dad these days, so I've had to sort of go back and dig around in the past of when I might have not been so happy with him and bring that up as an actor. You know, because this character is really angry.
As Stone makes up for lost time with his family, he's running out of time with the law. DEA agents are on his trail, and the cartel tightens its control over him, even as he is determined to keep his own timetable on the road. His illicit income is becoming more and more visible as he spreads money around.
He almost becomes like a Robin Hood character because he makes all this money unlawfully. But he goes around and starts helping people that need things.
But despite Eastwood's romantic spin on his stint as a drug mule, critics say the film glosses over the criminality of drug trafficking and the devastating effects of drugs and drug cartels on society. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Well, The Favorite and Roma lead the Academy Award nominations with 10 each. AP Entertainment correspondent Margie Sarzaletta has more.
This is madness.
Sometimes a lady likes to have some fun.
The Favorite and Roma are up for Best Picture, along with A Star is Born, Green Book, Black Panther, Black Klansman, Bohemian Rhapsody, and Vice. Roma is the first Netflix film to be nominated for Best Picture, while Black Panther is the first superhero movie nominated in that category. While Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga were nominated in acting categories for A Star is Born, Cooper was passed over for Best Director. The Oscars will be given out February 24th in Los Angeles. A host has yet to be named. I'm Margie Zaraletta.
And finally today, we will leave you with a bit of trivia. On this day, January 23rd, 1971, George Harrison was the first solo member of the rock sensation The Beatles to have a number one hit with the song My Sweet Lord. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but we thank you very much for being with us. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.